This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel round the world and back in time to revisit some audacious crimes, all of them committed by women. Women who are trying to make it in a world made for men. Our lady swindlers stepped outside their ordinary lives to do some extraordinary things. Imagine starting life in a tough neighbourhood of New York as an 8-year-old immigrant on the eve of the American Civil War. But you'll go on to live through the Gilded Age, the later 19th century, when America's rich are getting tremendously richer. The robber barons, as they're known, like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Vanderbilt, are travelling about in trains and hotels and luxury steamers. And you too can try to get a piece of the American dream in your own way.
I did not know it was wrong to steal. No one ever taught me that.
From a childhood of pickpocketing through to blackmail.
She suddenly sprang from the bed, put my clothes in the trunk, and said she wouldn't let me have them unless I paid her $10,000.
This week's lady swindler, just like a captain of industry, actually turned philanthropist in her old age.
You know how hard it is for a man or woman to secure permanent work after leaving prison? I am going to help some of these. They will find a friend in Sophie Lyons.
Our case today is one of deception, but also redemption. I'm exploring the story of Sophie Lyons, an American swindler known as the Queen of the Underworld. She is a bold chameleon of a woman. And I want to know, did she ever really reform her ways, as she claimed, after her lifetime of crime? I also want to know what her story tells us about the lives of women born into poverty and the choices they have, and what opportunities might open up in an America where the Civil War is over, slavery's been abolished, and everyone's out to make money. It's the 9th of July, 1878. It's a hot day. A beautiful and elegantly dressed, well-to-do widow from Connecticut, who calls herself Louisa Sylvan, is in the city of Boston. Louisa arranges to meet Charles Allen, a prominent lawyer and an elderly bachelor, to discuss a real estate transaction. She checks into the Revere House Hotel. This is the poshest hotel in town. It's the accommodation choice of diplomats and politicians. Charles comes to meet Louisa in her suite, room 11. He is bewitched by her beautiful raven locks and her sparkling black eyes.
I sat on the lounge beside her and talked business. She then began a tirade against the intense heat and said that it would be as well if we removed part of our clothing. Well, I, of course, was surprised and shocked at the idea and remonstrated against such an objectionable proceeding. She, however, paid no attention to my objections and began to systematically remove her clothing. After she had disrobed, with the exception of her undergarments, and asked me to lie down in bed with her, I, as a matter of course, did likewise. And we both retired.
But then, quick as a flash, Louisa snatches his clothes and she locks them in a big wooden trunk.
She suddenly sprang from the bed, put my clothes in the trunk and said she wouldn't let me have them unless I paid her $10,000. And then she came down to $1,500 and finally to $1,000.
Charles is trapped. He's wearing only his underwear. He feels he has no choice but to write her a check. Louisa runs off, disappearing into the streets of Boston. Now, with me here today to explore this intriguing story is our guest detective, Evie Pomporas. Evie is a former Secret Service agent, that's so cool, and NYPD officer. And she's also been a criminal investigator and interrogator. Evie, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Thank you for having me.
Evie, tell us a little bit more about your background and how you've spent your career studying and investigating crime.
Well, I started in the NYPD. I wasn't there very long before I went over to the U.S. Secret Service. And at the U.S. Secret Service, I worked as a special agent and an investigator. I also was an interrogator and polygraph examiner. So I would travel the country in the U.S. and I would help police departments with their most difficult cases. I'm also an adjunct professor at the City University of New York, and I teach criminal justice, criminology, sentencing, and policing.
Gosh, I so want to be you. I've got the biggest crush on you. It's fabulous. Now, Evie, you're hearing about this case in room 11 of the posh hotel with the mysterious Louisa Sylvan. Would you call this a honey trap or would you call it just blackmail? What's the technical term?
I would lean a little bit more towards a honey trap. You know, this isn't that uncommon, especially even in the espionage world where you use or you bait out women to tempt somebody, usually a male, to give up either information, to give up money. The thing with women is that you're not expecting it. And that's why even to this day, it's such an old trick and people still fall for it.
Now, back in Boston in 1878, after Louisa leaves room 11, she goes to a bank to try to cash this check from her unfortunate victim, Mr. Charles Allen. But the bank's employee suspects that the check is a forgery and gets suspicious. When Louisa can't give the names of anyone to vouch for her identity, he refuses to accept the check and he calls the police. While being escorted to the police station, Louisa tries to tear up and even to swallow the check, but the police stop her. At the police station, Louisa is searched and officers find the key to room 11 at the Revere House Hotel and, most crucially, the key to the trunk. The policemen go to the hotel where they discover a nearly naked Charles Allen in room 11 and they rescue his clothes. Back at the police station, he testifies that Louisa is the woman who attempted to con him and the police charge her with blackmail. She gets bail, but then she disappears. What the police don't yet realise is that this woman isn't Louisa Sylvan at all. They have in fact been dealing with the famous criminal and con woman Sophie Lyons. So what is Sophie's story? Barbara Gray is the former director of news research at the New York Times. She's now a professor at the City University of New York. She's writing a biography of Sophie and researching her early life.
I'm standing at the corner of Columbia and Delancey Street. It's in Manhattan's Lower East Side. Traffic is very busy here. Tons of parked cars, bikes, people on skateboards, taxis. I'm here because this is where Sophie lived after she arrived in New York in 1855, aged 8. Sophie Van Elken, as she was called then, had been born in Germany on Christmas Eve, 1847. Her family was Jewish and suffered discrimination, so they decided to move to America, hoping to make a better life. I have with me here the ship record. It says Sophie arrives in New York Harbor on December 26, 1855, on board the ship, the Von Stein, from Bremen, Germany. She's with her four siblings. These children seem to have traveled the entire journey unaccompanied. When Sophie and her siblings arrived in New York, they lived with their parents at 48 Columbia Street. It's right in front of me now, but actually the address no longer exists. It's part of the trestle leading to the entrance of the Williamsburg Bridge. But at the time, the area would have been a tenement-style apartment block of wooden buildings a few stories high. When Sophie lives here, the area is known as Klein Deutschland, Little Germany. with the largest German-speaking population in the world outside of Berlin and Vienna. It's a bustling neighborhood, horses, carts, and crowded streets. Inside the tenements, privacy is non-existent, with multiple families crammed into a two- or three-story house. It's a tough existence. Crime was used by many to make ends meet. Sophie is taught to steal and pick pockets from an early age by her stepmother. If she does well and makes her quota of three pocketbooks per day, she's rewarded. But if not, she's beaten and abused. And from the age of 12, she's in and out of prison. And it's a family affair. At one point, her whole family is held in the same prison at the same time. By the time she's a teenager, Sophie is in a gang led by a formidable woman, Friederike Marm Mandelbaum, a Jewish immigrant known as Queen of the Fences. Think of a female Fagin figure from Oliver Twist. It's under Marm Mandelbaum that Sophie learns how to navigate the police and court systems.
Sophie really knows no other life than crime, as she reflects back on in later years.
I did not know it was wrong to steal. No one ever taught me that.
Let me ask you, Evie, what sort of impact do you think it can have when you grow up with crime happening all around you?
Well, it's nature versus nurture. And one of the theories is that when you are around something like that, that you become what you learn. And when we actually look at crime, even today, if you grow up in a household where there is crime or nefarious activity, that becomes your norm.
It sounds like she really has very little choice other than to become a career criminal. I suppose if you have grown up like that, you could have very strong friends, family, community relationships. You just don't feel any empathy towards your victims. Is that right? Everybody knows the sort of stereotype of the criminal with a heart of gold, if you know what I mean.
I think here we're looking at a different type of criminal. She's a criminal who takes property, who takes money. And I will tell you, it was actually easier for me to get somebody to confess to a violent crime, because most people feel bad when they cause harm to someone, than it was to get a confession from someone who committed a money crime or property crime, because people don't feel as bad. People are able to put up this almost barrier, right? The space between themselves and the victim, especially today when we see people committing crime from even long distances. Right now we can do it through the internet, through other means.
Sounds like our Sophie is going to be a tough nut for us to crack then, as we try to get to the heart of what makes her tick. Sophie came to the US as a young child, Evie, and your family are also immigrants to the US, aren't they? From Greece originally. Is this idea of the American dream a story that you're personally familiar with?
I think when people come over, and my parents included, I don't know if they really came for the American dream. I think they came to survive. And the United States does give you those opportunities. You can have no connections, not really know anybody, and work really hard and establish yourself. There's something else that comes to play a role, and it's called strain theory. So strain theory is when I go somewhere and I see other people with wealth and I'm frustrated because I'm working and I'm hustling and I'm playing by the rules of society and I'm just not getting ahead. That's not fair, and I'm going to make up my own rules. So she's a little bit of that. Her family's a little bit of that.
Like many immigrants to America, Sophie has ambitions, but hers are criminal ones. In 1865, Sophie meets Ned Lyons, a notorious bank robber. He's 8 years her senior. They marry in December of that year, just before Sophie turns 18. The beginning of their relationship coincides with the end of America's Civil War. It's a time of hope. There's a feeling of egalitarianism, a feeling that a comfortable house and moderate prosperity is within anyone's reach. If you work hard enough, you too can be part of middle-class America. So industrialization and new technologies are bringing seismic change and incredible wealth. But cronyism, corruption, and laissez-faire capitalism create only a small number of extremely wealthy entrepreneurs. Many people, especially workers, are left impoverished. This is America's Gilded Age. And with the rise of the so-called robber barons, and with all this money on display in New York and in the big cities, there's plenty of opportunity for criminals, such as Ned and Sophie Lyons. In 1869, Ned and his associates rob the Ocean Bank near Wall Street. They steal around $500,000, which would be worth over $11 million today. Overnight, Ned and Sophie become extremely wealthy. They buy a brownstone in East Harlem for their growing family. They now have three children. They could even retire if they wanted to. But Ned can't resist the lure of another bank job. And this one lands him in prison. Sophie returns to shoplifting, but she too soon finds herself in the clink. Their children get sent to an orphanage. But remarkably, both Ned and Sophie manage to escape from the Sing Sing prison. They collect their children and they head to Montreal in Canada. But it isn't long before Ned's back inside and Sophie has to go it alone. And crime is the only way she knows how to make money for herself and her children.
With my husband in prison, the support of my little ones fell wholly on my shoulders, and I promptly turned to bank robbing as the easiest way I knew of making a living.
Does that ring a bell, Evie, with people that you've come across in your career? I turned to bank robbing as the easiest way I knew of making a living. Well, it wouldn't be the easiest way I could think of making a living, but it's what works for her, right?
If you're committing crimes from earlier on, this is what you do. This is what you continue to do. If I've never committed a crime, and I lose my job, I am less likely to go commit a crime because that's not the way I am wired to make money. So it's just a very different mental process. For Sophie, her process is, I do the smaller crimes, then I escalate, and then I escalate. It's an evolution. And once we see this, it's rarely likely that they will ever rehabilitate or change their ways.
Makes sense. So, back to our case. In room 11 of that hotel, Sophie, or Louisa as she claims to be, has been bailed after being charged with blackmail. She's broken bail. She goes on the run. She's soon committing more blackmail in cities across the US using many different aliases. The law finally catches up with her in Detroit, and she's once again put behind bars in Boston. And the case involving Charles Allen finally comes to court. But despite knowing that Louisa Sylvan is in fact the notorious Sophie Lyons, the prosecution has a really tough time trying to prove it. In court, Sophie wears a veil, a sort of modesty veil to hide her face. This seems bizarre now, but it is totally allowed at the time. It's a clever trick which makes it extremely difficult for witnesses to testify that Louisa and Sophie are the same person. Even the victim, Charles Allen, can't say for sure that the woman in the stand is the same person who lured him into room 11. After the trial, no verdict is reached, and 5 weeks later, Sophie walks free. Evie, that just wouldn't happen in court today, right? Somebody being allowed to disguise their appearance.
I'm completely baffled by this one. When you're in court, the person who's claiming that you committed a crime, they have a right to see your face and vice versa. So this is definitely something new for me.
Also, Sophie's good at using aliases, isn't she? We've heard about Louisa Sylvan. She had others. Do people still do this today?
Yes, people love them. If I don't have my ID on me, this is my name, all their makeup stuff. So that was actually quite a common issue because I could arrest somebody and they would have 15 different names. One of the things that did help us is called live scan fingerprinting. I would print a person and based on their fingerprints, it would come up in the system and tell me who they were. And sometimes all their aliases would come up.
Oh, wow. Have you ever used an alias when you've been working undercover?
Whenever I worked any type of undercover case, I am not using my real name. I am making everything up that I can think of because I don't want anything to come back to me personally. I would do everything I can, and so would my agency, to protect our identity.
Would you have any sort of personas that were good to go? Right, today I'm going to get my Evie Brown persona out of the drawer. Or did you have sort of several ones that you would use repeatedly? How does it work?
No, I didn't have any of those, although I love it. It's very theatrical. So it really depended on the cases. And I would not cross personas because you want to be careful because they all know each other. People in this world, they network. So you want to make sure that you don't get identified by somebody else because then you are in serious trouble.
So each time you go out into the field, as it were, you have to get a new lot of documentation made for you?
Sometimes I would need documentation, sometimes I wouldn't. It depended what I was doing. It's really interesting, actually. Had somebody ever asked me for my ID? No, not very smart criminals now that I think about it.
This is just my natural swattiness. If I was going undercover, I'd think I'd need a whole set of all of my documents good to go. Now, in Sophie's case, the police take over a year to find her following the business in Room 11. How does law enforcement go about finding someone on the run now? Presumably, it would probably happen more quickly.
I think today, yes. One thing is we have CCTV, which is cameras everywhere. That plays a massive role. You know what else plays a massive role? The iPhone. Today, anything goes down, somebody has their phone up. I think today it is much easier to catch people. Back then you could hide, you wouldn't resurface. It was hard to figure out who you were. Today, not so much.
Let's go back to Sophie's story. Sophie continues to travel across the US and Europe, masquerading as a high society American traveller, but still doing the pickpocketing. She gets arrested in Paris after a crime spree with her third husband. But most of the time, she passes as one of the great ladies of the Gilded Age. She is described as recently arrived in the first cabin of the French liner La Lorraine, attired in the latest Parisian style of dress, with several trunks and a jewel case and a personal worth of $500,000. But by 1896, Sophie is 48 years old and she's getting a bit tired. She announces to the newspapers that she's turning her back on crime and she settles down in the city of Detroit in the state of Michigan. Sophie now reinvents herself as a philanthropist with a special interest in prisoner reform.
You know how hard it is for a man or woman to secure permanent work after leaving prison? I am going to help some of these. They will find a friend in Sophie Lyons.
So, Evie, we have one of the most notorious criminals of her day supposedly turning her back on a life of crime. How believable is this to you?
Not very believable. I think she just came to an age where she's aging out of crime. She's just evolving to trying to figure out, how do I use what I've done to do something else that might be a little bit more legitimate?
Now, all over America today, you'll see libraries and concert halls. Think of the Carnegie Hall or the New York Public Library, which were funded by the so-called robber barons of America's Gilded Age. I wonder if there's a parallel here with Sophie, likewise, wanting to present herself in later life as a benefactor to the public.
I think so. I think she's just trying to take what she did and turn it around and say, you know what, I've learned from my ways. She wants to leave a name or a legacy. And she's thinking, I want notoriety.
Goodness me. In 1913, Sophie releases her memoir, which is what we've been hearing extracts of here. She calls her book Why Crime Does Not Pay. It details her schemes and her swindles, emphasizes that she's now reformed, and discouraging others from a life of crime. Back in New York, Barbara is digging into the archives to check the accuracy of some of Sophie's claims.
I have with me a copy of Why Crime Does Not Pay. Sophie is obviously proud of her achievements, and she gets a bit carried away. For example, Sophie writes a whole chapter about how she worked with another infamous swindler, Carrie Morse. Morse ran a sham ladies-only brokerage in New York City in the 1880s, swindling widows, sewing girls, and working women out of their savings, to the tune of what the Boston Globe estimated in 1887 at about $100,000, about $3.4 million in 2023 dollars. Sophie claims that she posed as Celia Rigsby, the president of Morse's sham company, of course, placing herself in the center of the story. But what do the newspapers tell us about this? There is no mention of Celia Rigsby in any articles. By November 1880, the swindle is exposed when Morse disappears and leaves her broke and humiliated investors with no recourse but to go to the police. Sophie's criminal timeline makes it doubtful that she played any part in this. In January 1880, when Morse is operating, we know that Sophie is in New York. However, by March 1880, Sophie is blackmailing wealthy businessmen in Jackson, Michigan, under yet another alias. The rest of the time before November 1880, when Moore's vanished, Sophie is in custody. So it's most likely that Sophie was not involved. It's much more likely that Sophie admired the work of Morse, as well as her ingenuity and ability to pull off such a successful scam, and so projected herself into the story to take some of that credit. Funnily enough, she doesn't talk about the Room 11 scam in her book at all.
Interesting. Sophie's memoirs are called Why Crime Does Not Pay, but it has paid literally for her. People are buying this book. What are the rules today about benefiting from the proceeds of crime, Evie?
So her writing the book and then getting paid, I think legally, even today, she would be able to do that. What would happen today is when you get arrested, they will take your stuff. And I have to tell you, Lucy, when I used to go to work, we had this garage downstairs of our office, and it had all these really nice cars that we had confiscated from people who committed crimes. And then when the person was found guilty, those vehicles would be auctioned off.
Evie, what do you finally feel about Sophie then? Do you have any sympathy for her life of crime, given her background? Or not.
The thing with Sophie is you can blame her, but you can't blame her because she started so young. But then you also have to say, well, at some point, you can make a choice to change your ways. I don't want to say that she's a bad person. I just think that this is the world she knows.
On the 7th of May, 1924, Sophie is visited at her home by three men. There are three theories about who the men are. A neighbour claims they wanted to rent a house. A rumour claims that they were members of a notorious gang of robbers. And a more sympathetic rumour suggests that Sophie was trying to reform them. Whichever it was, Sophie's heard to cry out, "Quit! Don't! Let me alone!" She collapses, and later that day she dies in hospital from a cerebral hemorrhage. She's 76 years old. In her will, she leaves half of her estate, which was worth over $4 million in today's money, to establish the Sophie Lyons Memorial Trust and to fund a home for the children of prison inmates. In actual fact, the will gets challenged and the home for children never comes to pass, but perhaps that bequest shows that her reformation was real. Sophie Lyons had a difficult start in life, but clearly she was a woman of many talents. A con woman, a femme fatale, a blackmailer, a pickpocket, and then later on, a really successful author too when she sold her story. Partly cautionary tale, partly self-redemption. She ended up with a fortune and she travelled the world. There are parallels here with the robber barons of the Gilded Age. She was an actual robber baroness. She saw opportunities, she capitalised on them. I suspect that Sophie would be quite pleased that we're discussing her here today. She liked attention, even though she would probably want to have had the last word. And perhaps that bequest in her will shows us that, after all, despite my cynicism, she really did in the end come to believe that crime does not pay. Next time, we're in London, on the trail of Victorian Britain's most notorious beauty scammer. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Laurel Lefkoe and Jonathan Keeble. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhianne Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4, and you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.